Legislative Commission on Fiscal Policy and Planning will come to order. We have several items that we wanted to cover today as expeditiously as possible. So we know it's a Friday. And we're going to start with Ms. Jane Ridley, who works at Standard & Poor's. After apparently multiple approvals by supervisors, she is allowed to come and talk with us a little bit about bonding and that mysterious business.
We try not to make it mysterious.
Welcome.
Need a mic.
Oh, yeah, where is the mic up there?
Is there a need to be a mic?
Oh, they're on the floor.
They're under the floor, but I... It is the Senate, so I'm not quite sure I know how to do that. But. I think they go underneath the chair that Jane is sitting next to. Well.
You want it back?
I don't think Senator Cohen would like that too much.
Working, yes.
Or Senator Langseth.
No, we'd swap you out.
Swap me out for room 10?
I think it's somehow involved.
I bet the House chamber.
Does it work?
Yes, I think it does.
Okay. Welcome.
A little closer. Thank you. I talk pretty loudly anyway, so if I need it. But yes, as you said, it did take several approval levels for me to come. They're somewhat particular at Standard & Poor's these days about what we can talk about and what we can't talk about. And but I do thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Jane Hudson Ridley, and I am a director at Standard & Poor's in Chicago. I'm the team leader for the state and local government analysts there, and we have about 13 analysts that cover credits throughout the Midwest. And I'm honored to have been invited, and I'm pleased to hear that you would like some of our feedback. I think that's great. So I have been the primary analyst on the state of Minnesota for about 6 years, since 2002, meaning I cover the state with regularity. Whenever there's a bond issue, I'm the analyst for it. I've also been involved in the ratings on most of the major issuers in the state that we have ratings on, so Minneapolis, Hennepin County, St. Paul, Ramsey County. A wide variety of issuers like that, from the big ones to some of the little ones, too. So Bill Marks gave me an idea of what you would want me to address today, and so I'm going to just give you a little bit of background about what we do and how we look at some things. Most of the questions were related to financial management, and we have a particular way that we look at financial management and base ratings on some factors that are critical there. So I'm going to address a few Minnesota-specific things, but I'm primarily going to talk about criteria that would affect all ratings and specifically state ratings as well. GO or general obligation bond ratings, regardless of the issuer size or type, are based on four main factors: economy, finances, management, and debt. As I'm sure you all know, Minnesota is rated AAA, and as are many of the other ratings that we do have in the state.
With your house?
Yes. And everything that I refer to today will only be related to Standard & Poor's.
And we have Mr. Marks, Mr. Mossman, how many houses rate us?
Three.
Three? And what are our ratings from the other two? Thank you very much.
So the strength of the ratings in the state really go beyond economy and finances, which are two of our main factors, as I said, to really the management as well. That's a very important part of rating. So, and actually, thoughtful, prudent management is really one way to separate what we call a AA+, which Moody's calls a AA1, from a AAA. That's really a critical factor for us. So. Since management is an important part of our ratings, and we wanted to be able to make more transparent the analysis of the management that we do and apply really a consistent framework to how we look at management in all ratings. And we introduced something called the Financial Management Assessment in 2006, so it was about 2.5 years ago. And you should have a copy, I believe, of the criteria for our financial management assessment in the package that you got today. I'm going to go through that briefly, but there's more information there as a background for you as well. So the FMA, or Financial Management Assessment, covers the seven areas most likely to affect credit quality. So those are revenue and expenditure assumptions, budget amendments and updates, long-term financial planning, long-term capital planning, investment management policy, debt management policies, and reserve and liquidity policies. And we ask, in order to make sure this is a framework for everyone, we ask the same questions from the state, at the state level, to a library district in Indiana, to, you know, to a small city in Alaska. Everybody has the same questions that we ask. So and to give you a little bit more background on the things that we're looking for in each of these areas, revenue and expenditure assumptions are really looking to see if governments do historical-based budgeting. So are they looking back to see what the trends were in their expenditure and revenue assumptions over in their expenditure and revenue projections in prior years in order to make the current budget, or are you just kind of doing it year to year? Budget amendments and updates. We want to know how often the governing body, the stakeholding, the elected officials in a government are hearing budget to actual results. How closely is that being watched? Long-term financial planning. Does the government do any kind of multi-year financial forecasting to look to see what might be presenting pressures out in the future? Long-term capital planning. Is there a long-term capital improvement plan that goes out several years that has sources identified in it to know how major capital projects will be addressed? Investment management policy. Is there an investment management policy? In some places, it's just the state policy. But even more critical than that, then are the stakeholders, the elected officials, seeing regularly what the holdings are, so that somebody knows where the money is being kept, and if it's in appropriate vehicles for the government.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, what would constitute our state officials looking at the holdings? Now, we have a state investment board that includes the governor,
yes,
the attorney general, the auditor. Is that sufficient to meet that criteria?
Yes, that is. And I was going to mention this in a minute. Minnesota actually has we have four different scores: strong, good, standard, and vulnerable. Minnesota is the highest level in terms of the financial management assessment. And in terms of investments, yes, it is state investment board that we look to as having those members and the stakeholders really seeing on an ongoing basis where the holdings are.
Thank you.
Debt management policy. I know this is a hot topic here in terms of the debt management policy in Minnesota. Is there a debt policy? In most states, we do see some kind of at least parameters on debt, maybe not strict policies, but what is their policy? What does the policy entail, and is it being adhered to? Or really, the big questions on that one. And then reserve and liquidity policies. Is there a formal reserve policy? Is there a formal fund balance policy? Something like that, where you need to keep reserves, you want to keep reserves. And then, are you meeting that policy? If you have a policy and you don't use it, then it really doesn't do much good. So. As I said, the responses to those seven areas, we kind of combine those all together. There are four scores: strong, good, standard, and vulnerable. And the FMA score really does have an impact on our ratings and how we look at credits, and it's featured prominently in our credit write-ups as well. And FMA scores actually in Minnesota are by and large either strong or good. There are a few standards, but overall financial management for entities across the state are really quite really quite strong. So that was kind of a bit of background for you.
Which ones aren't strong? Which ones are just good?
That I have a list on my BlackBerry, but I can send that to you. So
well, if staff has it, we can get it.
Okay, all right, I can do that. Let me make a note of it. Okay. And let me just say, I can tell you, it's a bell curve in terms of what scores we do have. It is uncommon, and this is one reason why I did make the comment, too, about the strong and good scores in Minnesota. It's uncommon to have most of your municipalities as strong or good scores. It's a bell curve in terms of standard is most of our scores are come out in the standard range. There are more strongs than there are vulnerables, as I recall, but it really is, you got a lot of school districts in there, and school districts by and large don't have the ability to do some of the planning and other things because of their challenges. So get a lot of standards in that. So unless there are any other questions, I can just kind of go into some of the things that I understand you would like to talk about today. So, okay. What does Standard & Poor's look at when preparing a bond rating? As I said, the four main factors, economy, finances, management, and debt. States are different than smaller governments due to the nature of your revenue sources and some of the fluctuations there, and the dependence on economic forecasting in order to come up with what you're projecting for revenues. That can present a challenge for a local municipality. It presents a challenge that a local municipality or school district doesn't have the same kinds of challenge with. And the potential fluctuations that go along with that, and the need that then to change your expenditures accordingly when you have kind of midstream revenue changes. We put a lot of stock in both the ability and willingness to make adjustments when you need to make adjustments. Management policies and practices that address that are very important, which is why the financial management assessment is such a key tool for us as well. Okay, what are priorities for good state fiscal management? One of the most critical factors in terms of fiscal management is structural balance. So revenues exceeding expenditures or meeting expenditure levels. And having an ongoing structural balance is very important. So if something disrupts balance, or generally it's when something disrupts structural balance, putting it back into balance structurally we view as critical. Basically, the economy may throw you off track, but we really look to management to put you back on track. What are priorities when coming out of a financial downturn? First, basically, one of the things that we would look for is making any changes that you make would be not necessarily one-time things, but things that are going to ripple forward, that are going to help with structural balance in the future, because keeping and regaining structural balance is really one of the key factors that we're looking to. And in terms of not just financial management, but also in terms of maintaining ratings. And we understand using reserves sometimes is necessary, and that's one of the reasons why you have reserves, is to be able to use them when you have something unexpected happen. But if reserves are used, when reserves are used, we generally look to see if there is a bigger plan in terms of either revenue enhancements or budget cuts or a combination of both, in order to just not solve the problem with one-time, you know, revenue or sources or whatever, and then, you know, kind of go on from there, because that doesn't get you back to where you need to be structurally balanced. Taking those actions in terms of adjusting revenues or adjusting expenditures, et cetera, are especially important when it's an economic factor. If it's not a one-time capital need or something like that might throw you off balance, but an economic factor that is going to ripple through for several years through an economic cycle. What are good practices in other states, and what are red flags? As a AAA with a strong FMA, Minnesota is generally one of the states that we would consider if other people asked, a good state with examples of what what good policies and planning techniques are. But I also did bring an article, and this should be in your packet as well, the top 10 management characteristics of highly rated credits in U.S. public finance. This is kind of a perennial list of what we like to see, and a lot of these things are things that are covered in the financial management assessment. But I would pull out a couple of them for you to take a look at in terms of good balance and that kind of and planning techniques. The first one is number 3, prioritize spending plans and establish contingency plans for operating budgets. Contingency planning should be an ongoing exercise for governments. In our opinion, it's good public policy to have contingency plans and options to address budget imbalances when they occur. There are some bullet points here that dig a little deeper. What part of the budget is discretionary, where revenue flexibility exists, that kind of thing. There's a little bit more on that in there, and then there are some others. I'd also draw your attention to number 8. On page 4, a multi-year financial plan in place that considers the affordability of actions or plans before they are part of the annual budget. So the important part here is that it is comprehensive. And this is a lot like the long-term financial planning metric that I mentioned in the financial management assessment. So can what goes up in strong times be sustained during lean times, or is there a plan of what can be adjusted if necessary? And I'd also point out number 6 on here. As I said, I know that your debt levels and looking at how you're going to finance capital needs in the future has been something that you've been focused on. Number 6, a debt affordability model in place to evaluate future debt. we look at policies and practices regarding debt and whether or not they're adhered to. We do look a bit at the policy to see how comprehensive it is, but really what we want to see is whether or not they're adhered to. We understand sometimes policies have to be changed or they have to be updated, but what we really look for overall is a well-thought-out guiding policy or plan that works for you and that you stick to. That's really the overall.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Senator Pogue-Miller. Ms. Ridley, you just said something that I think we need to talk about a little bit. In Minnesota, we have a set of guidelines for our debt management. Some of them are very specific. Some of them are more in guideline form. Mm-hmm. My understanding is they haven't been updated for 20 years. And we were going to actually put it in legislation last year that they should be updated. My understanding is the Department of Finance said to legislators, we're going to update them because they need to be updated. If a state like Minnesota updates or modernizes their guidelines, how does a rating agency or how would your rating agency look at that modernization of guidelines, especially if it would result in a different calculation of debt level?
Well, really what we're looking for is a policy that works for each individual government, not a one-size-fits-all policy. So in terms of having something and updating something, that certainly, you know, if it's outdated, if it doesn't make sense anymore, that we would not view that as an issue. If it's something that's well thought out and it works for the state, that's really the factor. We want to see something that you are going to do, that you're going to meet not only now but also in the future. To modernize something is not in and of itself a concern.
And Ms. Ridley, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ridley, the other question, I actually between my daughter's hockey game, I read the downgrade of the Illinois rating and the California rating last night. And one of the things it talked about in the California rating is a concern about debt per capita, mm-hmm. and a concern that they are I think, in the new calculation, looking at $1,900 per person in California, their debt. And they do it a little differently. They have short-term borrowing. They have some other things that we don't engage in as a state. Can you give us an idea of kind of where we fall in the mix of states in terms of debt per capita?
As I recall, Minnesota falls out kind of in the middle of debt per capita of the 50 states. I think it's in the 22 or 25 on debt per capita. California is on the very high end of that. I think Minnesota's debt per capita is about $875 a person, as opposed to, as you said, California, maybe about $1,900. And that does include a lot of the short-term borrowing that California has done this year, some of the deficit borrowing. So that really, it puts Minnesota kind of in the middle of the pack on that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ridley, the borrowing that California does, is that divided into capital and operating? Do they do borrowing for operating? We do not in Minnesota or haven't.
That I do not. I cannot say for certain. I believe that they do, but I can't say for certain. I'm not the analyst for the state of California, but I can get that information to you. I don't want to give you the wrong information.
Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be interesting to see for comparing.
Okay. I believe that it is, but.
Yeah. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your rating scheme, how do you view tax increases in times of economic stress to balance budgets?
Well, we don't look at it as much in terms of how it affects the local municipalities as what the end result is for the government. So it is, we're not going to say they raised taxes when things were tough. And that's going to impact the bond rating. What we're going to say is more likely revenues are not meeting expenditures, and it's an ongoing problem.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Red flags, that was one of the other parts of this question. The examples on red flags, chronic shortfalls, issues that aren't addressed that you know are coming or that you don't know are coming and still aren't addressed, or habit of structural imbalance. Those are all red flags. The next question was, does S&P look at factors differently in good times versus bad times? I think that's a little bit of the question there. The bottom line on that is that our job is to get the rating right regardless of economic or market conditions, and what the impact is to the financial health of the government. A long-term rating has a long-term time horizon. We're looking out for the life of the bonds. In many cases, that's 20, 30, even sometimes 40 years. We do adjust ratings in the interim, but we need to look at it as a long-term issue, and that's why we emphasize so much on planning. How governments react in good times can tell us how they're going to react often in lean times and kind of a vice versa. As I said before, budgets do inflate, and it's being able to trim them down in the lean times that really presents the challenge, and that's, as I said, why the future planning is so important. There's also a question about drawing down reserves. As I said before, reserves are there basically for a reason, and it is sometimes to deal with unexpected occurrences. It can be an important tool to get through those periods of time, but one-shot solutions to combat economic challenges aren't going to get you to a structurally balanced level. So that's why planning for the future is so critical. We know the state does a lot of that. That also means considering all factors that have an impact on your financial position, including inflation. Whenever your folks come to New York to meet with us and they give us projections for the next biennium without inflation, it's our job to ask, what is this number with inflation in it? It's critical for us to understand those kinds of things and how big or small the impact might be, to see how big or small the problem is and how it could impact the rating. And I'd like to just add one last thing. As I said, I know you've been looking at your debt guidelines, and I've discussed the state debt capacity forecast with your folks before in meetings that we've had. As we talked about before, if you're going to make changes, what we would be looking for is just how the policy is going to fit you, how you think you're going to meet it both now and in the future in terms of projections. Changing it once isn't necessarily a problem. Changing it once, changing again in 2 years or a year, that's what we would look to see, is that it's not going to be a long-term guiding principle for you. So as long as a policy, if it's changed, if it's something that makes sense for you and it's adhered to, that's really what we're looking for. So that was all that I had prepared to talk about. So,
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ridley, in looking for comparisons and looking for ways to do things better, I think we don't want to go off and look at states that are dissimilar or maybe don't have as good a practices. So what would your recommendation be for best practices in terms of financial management? And you don't necessarily, if you have states that you want us to look at, great, but are there some ideas or principles that we should follow as we look at best practices for financial management? We're very proud here in Minnesota that we do things well, but sometimes I think we need to look to other places that maybe have innovated or taken it to the next level. Ideas about that?
We can't really give you suggestions as to actually what you should do, but I can say that most any state that we have at AAA is generally the policies and practices in those states are quite strong. We have about 10 AAA states at this point, and I can send you a list of those, of our ratings, and also of the states that have strong financial management assessment scores. That'll give you a good idea of things to look at in those states. I can send you the analyses that analysts have written up. Also, we have a paragraph for each state rating that we do about each of the policies.
Thank
it gives
you.
A little synopsis.
Other questions?
I was
Representative Carlson.
Interested in the way in which you would make changes. Do you give feedback while the changes are in progress, or does your feedback come after the change is made?
You mean in terms of a rating?
Well, if we were to change, like, let's say the debt management or some component that you look at when states are reviewing and making changes, do you give feedback as those changes are being discussed?
We can do that. That's not – we have a special product to do that. Otherwise, what we do is rate what's presented to us. So if you change your debt policy the next time you come in for a bond rating, we will rate it We'll rate the debt based on the new policy. As I said, there is something, and I can have someone get in contact with you about this, one of our business management people. We do have something that says sometimes governments will want to know, what if we do this? What if we do that? Or what if we do that? And we can only rate one scenario. We can only rate one thing at a time, but we do have something that says we will rate them each individually and say, if you do this, this is what your rating will be. If you do this, this is what your rating will be, and so on, for a number of scenarios. But otherwise, it's just the one shot.
Thank you.
Ms. Ridley, I want to ask this delicately. When you're doing ratings, do you do any independent fact gathering, or do you basically depend upon what the representatives of the governmental unit tell you when they come to see you?
We do both. We use in terms of state financial projections or anything else, we use Global Insight for our projections as well, which I know the state uses. We also certainly take into account what the state is saying, because you're here on the ground and your economist, you know, does a good job for us in terms of what you see and how it's going to impact you. In terms of other sources, economic data and those kinds of things, yes, we do use outside sources. So we use a host of different things.
Okay, that's data, facts that are
right.
Available.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also people making a presentation to you about
yes.
What's going on in that state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typically the executive branch.
Yes.
Have you ever been misled by any executive branch that you're aware of?
Not that I am aware of, no.
How would you guard against that?
I think that if we feel what we're really dealing with and what we're basing ratings on is not politics, it's not what's swirling out in the media or anything else. We're dealing in facts, and a fact is either true or it's not true. If we do have a situation that we don't think that and I can think of only very few instances where I'm even concerned that I've even been concerned that was a problem, then we'll take that into account. But that's really not something in general that we're, that we're generally faced with in our experience. If it's just one thing, maybe there's something you can kind of slide under. I don't know. I can't, sitting on this side of the table, I can't be sure. But if it's a habit, a habit of doing that kind of thing, then we'll, or it's generally more lack of information than anything else that can
So again,
us.
I'm trying to be delicate how I ask this, but we're a state that's out of balance. We're a state that we do have inflation in our forecast that you can see. It's not advertised in the state.
Yes.
But it's in the forecast.
Yes.
As a footnote.
Yes.
And we have lower reserves than we probably should, but we're still AAA. Just a curiosity, how does that happen?
Well,
not asking you to lower it. I'm just asking you to just add, I've listened to your testimony, and I'm sitting here going, gee, become AAA. I mean, we borrowed on the basis of using our federal dollars for transportation and ended up in a cash flow problem in transportation, we found out last summer. I'm just curious. Again, I'm not looking to convince you to lower our rating. I'm just asking.
I can't do that alone anyway. It is a committee process, but a lot of it has to do with the planning and the forward-looking, forward-looking planning and other things that you do, the way that you've managed it up to this point, maintaining reserves. I know you've had to cut into them some this year, but one of the big ways that in a few years ago when there was when you were going through some of the same problems, having those tobacco dollars, it was almost $1 billion in tobacco dollars, that was a big part of being able to maintain a strong rating was having those reserves and also making changes. If next time we meet, and I believe we have a phone call next week with the folks in the finance department, if next time we talk to them, they say we're using reserves and we're not going to change anything, that's going to be a concern. If they say we're using reserves and we're making changes to our expenditures, we're making changes to our revenues, whatever else, that makes a big difference. Did that answer your?
It did, but again, you're our guest, so I'm not trying to be difficult, but would that same testimony have been given in the financial industry a year or two ago, and here we sit now?
I can't address that. I can address municipal ratings. I can address how we look at ratings, but I can't I mean, I can't speak to hindsight. I can't speak to anything else.
So different people do governmental ratings than did the financial industry ratings in your shop?
Yes, we have our rating. My group, my department is strictly state and local government ratings. We do general obligation-backed ratings. We do revenue-backed ratings, leases, and some other things like that.
And are the standards the same for the both groups? Or
we have different criteria.
Standards? Okay, and maybe you could, I think it would give some of us some comfort to know that you had better criteria for governmental units than for what happened in the other sectors.
I can't say that. That I can't make that assessment. Okay. I can say that we have, you know, we have a long history of ratings that, you know, our municipal ratings go back quite a ways. And if you, I mean, in terms of those kinds of things, I can have someone get in contact with you about discussing some of the greater global S&P issues. What I need to talk about today is how we look at ratings on the state and our criteria related to that.
I wasn't trying to be a bad host.
That's fine.
I was just trying to figure out if there are some things we should be thinking about as your industry kind of assesses what has happened here in the last few years, too.
And I don't at all mean that
as a criticism of your shop. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the world isn't quite exactly the way we thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why I had to have several levels of sign-off in order to come today to talk about the specific thing. So,
I mean, I think it's fair to say legislators basically view Standard & Poor's and Moody's and stuff as God. You know, you tell us the word. And I think that's been shaken a little bit.
I think Dr. Stinson's God.
Oh, is Dr. Stinson God?
I think he might be.
I didn't mean it to be rude. I just meant it. I think we're all kind of wondering, you know, what should we be thinking about? What caution should we be taking just to make sure that we're okay.
Right, and I can't, you know, I can't answer that for you.
Okay. Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious as to how you would define a reserve. You know, for example, in Minnesota we have a reserve account, but we also have a cash flow account. And I'm assuming that the accounting approaches in the different states vary, so how would you in a general way define what a reserve is? And what made me think of is your reference to the dollars we had 3 years ago in tobacco
so. Pretty much what we would define as a reserve is what you define as a reserve. You say these are our reserves. In some states it's in a rainy day fund. In some states it's in a budget stabilization fund. And there can be different names for funds, but it's what the group of monies that you think of as your reserves and are being described in your documentation and other things as reserves.
So our tobacco endowment was described as a reserve in the documentation to you?
It was moved into the general fund, and that's what we would refer to as a general fund reserve.
Oh, I don't think most of the legislators thought that was a reserve, but anyhow, that's not, I just...
Oh, it was treated as one.
Huh?
It was treated as one. I think whether we believe it was one or not, it was, the effect was the same, so...
And that's why I say we don't define it. We look at what is the bottom line, what's in the general fund. That's the main operating fund of most governments, and so that's what we're looking to what's in there. If you say we have an additional reserve outside the general fund as a budget stabilization or something else, then we look at, you know, we'll take a look at that as well in a special revenue fund or something else.
Other questions? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Redley. Just to carry that question one step further, might it be possible that a piece of Minnesota land could be a reserve, say a wildlife management area, or would you go that deep?
We likely would not take that. We're looking at available reserves, like a financial cash type reserve.
Thank you.
Is our health care access fund viewed as a reserve?
We generally, what we're looking at and what we're quoting in our write-ups as reserves are the cash flow reserve and the budgetary reserve, the two. We would look to other funds in terms of, if you say this is additional liquidity, if there are financial challenges, then there can be cash flow issues. We'll say, what other cash flow do you have, or what other liquidity do you have to be able to tide you over if you aren't going to do cash flow borrowing or something else.
Other questions? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, how do you account for states who have sold off assets to generate cash? Pennsylvania, Indiana on their toll roads, Chicago on their Skyway, and possibly their airport. Are those considered, they must be considered reserves or cash, near cash stuff? Mm-hmm.
How we view those in the long run, then, is what they're used for. If you sell something and you set the money aside and it's a special reserve or anything else, then that's, you know, that's viewed in one way, that you've got these reserves and you're holding on to them in case of emergency. But if you're going to use them, if you're going to sell something and use it for operations, that's a little bit different. I know Chicago has done a pretty good job in terms of when they sold the Skyway, holding on to that money and saying we're going to use X amount of it every year for several years, and they have kept with that. And that's, you know, it's the planning part of it, and that's what I've tried to emphasize today. It's the planning part of it and the looking forward part of it that are two of the things that we really focus on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you asked this before, but you you could consider a lot of state assets as reserves or near cash position if the state or the city was prepared to unload those to the general public, I would think.
Well, generally, we don't really give you credit for anything until it's happened. So if it's sold and you say we've got the money in the bank, I mean, we talked to some issuers that, for years, they're going to sell an asset, they're going to balance the budget by selling this asset, and it just doesn't transpire. And so until it transpires, then we not only want to, you know, we don't quite give you credit for it until then. And then after that, if you say we're going to sell it, we're going to hold on to it, that's really what you do after that is what we're looking at also.
Thank you.
Madam Speaker.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Ridley, it sounds like that if you propose something and in a budget, but you know there's no chance of it happening,
mm-hmm.
it's really unrealistic,
mm-hmm.
it is really kind of a gimmick then instead of a solution to the long-term problem.
It is. I think that would be fair to say, and I think it's also entities that do that. When we do have some entities that we rate that chronically do that, they have, you know, assumptions that are greater than what they're actually going to do, those entities are not rated AAA.
Any other questions? So on a lighter note, are you born and raised in Illinois?
No, I'm actually from Northern Virginia.
Oh, because I was going to ask you how it feels to, you know, no good deed goes unrewarded. You have a president, and now you have a governor of interesting. You got a lot going on in that state.
We do. It keeps it very interesting, yes.
Thank you so much for,
Thank you for having me.
The time to visit. And we really appreciate the hard work and the good work that you do for our state.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much.
When we come to you, at least.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
And now we're going to hear from our
Triple B by the
Mr. Title. Good News, Dr. Stinson. and I've asked, Dr. Stinson has made various presentations. I think we've all heard them. So basically we're asking him to just if there's anything new we should be thinking about, provide that information to us. Mr. Stinson's good to see you again. And I was kidding. You're doing a great job. It can't be the funnest thing that you do day to day, but
you know, it is more fun to announce surpluses than deficits. I wondered about that, but I'm pretty sure that's right.
Well, your stable hand is something that at least for me gives comfort that we're getting the facts as best you know them, and we appreciate that very much. So, Mr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to spend very much time on the pressing facts. What I want to do is bring you up to date as to what we have learned since the forecast. And this information has come out kind of piecemeal, and one of the things that, some of it's, you know, still coming out now, but I have a handout, and I'll just go through it real quickly, but on the bottom of the first page, it shows that taxes are down for the current fiscal year. Top of the second page, taxes are down for the next fiscal year as well. The bottom of the second page shows the capital gains forecast, and I want to reiterate the uncertainty involved with this forecast. You know, this is something that we're very concerned about. We have a 30% decline, but a lot of states are choosing 50% or more. I heard somebody from California yesterday quoted as saying every time the stock market goes down, it costs us another $1 billion in the current current fiscal year in terms of revenue losses. The one reassuring piece of news, a little bit reassuring piece of news, I guess is the right way of putting it, is I had a long conversation with a friend of mine in the Congressional Budget Office who does the federal capital gains projections. We're forecasting at 30% down. He's forecasting at 37% down. And given the blend, Minnesota's not the biggest state in the country, and California, you'd certainly expect to be having more problems. And so it looks like at least our model and his model, which are quite different models, are coming to more or less the same conclusion. So we'll go down together as opposed to separately anyway.
Well, we're 130 down right now in the stock market today.
Only 130, so.
Not too bad, huh?
You know, if you think about the news with the auto bailout failing, I would have thought it would have been down even more than that. But apparently the market wasn't real optimistic that this was going to go through anyway. So.
Dr. Stinson, it's not the afternoon yet, though. This market goes crazy in the afternoon, and it's Friday.
The top of page 3 and the bottom of page 3 are in there just to give you some idea of changes from forecast in February and to set the baseline for the news that comes a little bit later, which is to show you what the December forecast is. Top of page 4 shows the job loss that we're expecting. We're expecting an additional 50-plus thousand jobs to be lost between now and the end of 2009. I think Mr. Hine is going to give you some ideas to where those job losses thus far have come. We expect to see job losses across the board, construction, manufacturing being the two biggest sectors, but also significant amounts in retail trade as well. What I want to spend just a little bit of time pointing out to you is the big change in the outlook of Global Insight. It's not just Global Insight. I heard a conversation that Mark Zandi has that he puts out on the web with his staff before he does the forecast or before he releases the forecast every month. And Mark Zandi, who's head of MoodysEconomy.com, is another national stature economic forecaster. He started out by saying, this month I think is the largest change in the forecast in my professional history. He said, and you know, I think I said that last month too, that things are really moving here. They're moving very quickly. Global Insight, if you look at the chart at the bottom of page 4, Global Insight in their November forecast had a 3.3% decline in the scheduled for the fourth quarter of 2008 and a 2.3% decline in the first quarter of 2009. Those quarterly numbers have been revised down a lot. They now expect a decline at a 5% annual rate in the fourth quarter of 2007, the dark bar, in other words. And then the dark bar again, 3.8% decline in the first quarter of 2009. those are significant changes to the outlook, and they will affect this biennium receipts. After that, the forecast is more or less the same, that it has the same path out, but as everybody in this room is well aware, if you start from a lower base and grow at the same rate, you lose money over time, and so this extends not just in 2009, but will extend into the 2010-2011 budget receipts. On the top of page 5 is a graph that some of you have already seen, and it shows what the change in annual rates is from November. Went for the current calendar year, growth rate went from 1.3 to 1.2. There's not a lot you can do with just one quarter's data. But for calendar 2009, the growth rate or the rate of decline went from 1% decline to 1.8% decline. In the briefings that we did for leadership prior to the release of the forecast, actually we said the recession could be worse than forecast in November, and I showed you a graph that had both the optimistic and the pessimistic scenario from Global Insight as well as the baseline scenario. This shows the baseline scenario from November, the heavy line. The dashed line is the December scenario, and the smaller dashed line that's even lower is the December pessimistic scenario. There are two things that are disturbing about this graph. One is that in the early part of the next year, well, for the next year, actually, not just the early part, but for the next 12 months, the December baseline scenario is below the November pessimistic scenario. The second thing is that Global Insight has assigned a probability of 40% to their pessimistic scenario for December. That's something that we're just not used to seeing, that kind of probability assigned. My staff yesterday listened to a call with Global Insight and said that it sounded like they were moving even more probability to the pessimistic scenario. Now, if you look at this scenario, this pessimistic scenario, it's a little bit deeper recession than is in the baseline scenario. But that's not the real important thing. The real important thing is that the recession lasts 6 quarters more instead of, well, has 6 consecutive quarters of decline as opposed to 4 consecutive quarters of decline. So it means that the economy continues to decline, that the base goes lower through the end of 2009 instead of just through the early part of 2009 and beginning to turn up sometime in the summer.
Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, just because I think people sometimes need to hear things a couple of times, could you go through again the significance of the chart on the bottom of page 4 and how significant it is that December is not just a little bit different than November, but significantly different? And then again, the bottom of page 5, talking about the space between what was, in past terms, the November forecast, and then the larger dashed line, and what that space between means again.
Certainly, Madam Chair. The bottom of page 4, if you look at the change between the lighter colored bar and the darker colored bar in the current quarter and the change between the lighter colored bar and the darker colored bar in the first quarter of 2009. It means that the economy is now expected to shrink more than was projected in November.
And which is when the forecast. So what you're saying is the forecast that you gave us in November was based on the light lines.
On the light lines, exactly.
You know today that the dark lines are closer to reality based on new information in December.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
And what that means is, and there's a slide that is coming that will give you a little bit of information here. But what that means is that compared to what Global Insight thought was going to happen in the national economy in November, there are going to be fewer jobs, more jobs lost. There's going to be less in the way of retail sales. The wages are going to be down. That almost certainly corporate profits are going to be down. And all of those things will bring down state revenues as well.
And those are all worse than when you gave us the November forecast.
Yeah,
that's the point. That's why you're here today.
The point is that we're in one of the forecasters' nightmares, which is that you do the forecast, you put it out, it takes you 2 or 3 weeks, and the economy changes so much that your forecast is almost out of date before it was issued. Now,
I think that's the point you were trying to get, Madam
yes.
Speaker. So, okay, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller. I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. I think I am, but Dr. Stinson, the fact that the dark lines are a little better than the light lines in the years out, we should take no solace in that because we're starting from a lower base, correct?
So that's
actually not necessarily a good sign because of the problem that we have in the end of 2008 and early 2009.
Representative Coles, yes, what you need to do is this shows the change. The graph on the next page, the solid line versus the larger dashed line, that shows the change, or that shows the actual level. And so if you look, you can see that the dashed line is below the solid line. Now, it's not below a huge amount, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's below, and what is particularly disconcerting is that Global Insight is saying, you know, it's 50-50 almost between the wider dashed line and that smaller dashed line that's underneath it, which is dramatically different from what we used in the forecast. That's the pessimistic, and it's both a deeper recession than is expected in the baseline, and it extends out for two more quarters of decline than the baseline does. And so that really does move levels down significantly.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, I'm wondering whether the Global Insight analysis, to what extent is it static versus dynamic in one sense? We have an incoming presidential administration that is promising a massive stimulus program. We can debate the merits of that. This isn't the time for that. But I'm wondering to what extent, if any, does Global Insight take into account the potential stimulative effect that we're being told might happen? In other words, does this assume that the Obama administration gets its way, or does it make no assumption about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, this assumes $200 billion of stimulus package almost immediately. That appears to be insufficient at this point. And in kind of keeping track of the potential stimulus coming from a potential stimulus package, what you need to pay attention to is not only the size, but the number of years that the stimulus package is to be administered over, and where that money is going to be dedicated. To the extent that you have an $800 million $800 billion stimulus package that extends over 3 years, and $600 billion of it is infrastructure in years two and three. That's not going to help the problem.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Sisson. So just so I understand correctly, you're saying this assumes $200 billion in immediate stimulus and perhaps much more in the out years, in years two and three.
Mr. Chairman, no, it doesn't assume much more in the out years. It assumes assumes $200 billion in stimulus package. Well, I was going to read you it, but I'm not going to. It assumes $200 billion in stimulus package. About $50 billion of that is money that would go to the states. If I remember right, about half of it would be Medicaid detached, and about half of it would be block grant type of stimulus. About 100 of it is infrastructure, and so would phase in over time. It doesn't come in directly, and about 50 of it, or 30 to 50 of it, I can't remember the exact numbers, is in the form of direct payments to individuals, increased food stamps, increased extended benefits for unemployment insurance, things like that.
Mr. Chair, just one more. Do you know whether that assumption improved the numbers? In other words, had that not been in there, would these numbers have looked worse?
Mr. Chairman, certainly they would have looked worse.
Okay, continue.
Global Insights December forecast was made completed prior to last Friday's jobs numbers. Last Friday's jobs numbers were a shock. If you thought that Global Insights forecast was a little pessimistic, they were a shock. What happened on last Friday is that we found out that instead of having lost 1.1 million jobs over the year, we had lost 1.9 million jobs, and 530,000 of them had been lost in the month of November. And if you pay attention to the initial unemployment claims, the national initial unemployment claims, and other items, it looks like we're on track for another really bad month in December.
Mr. Chairman?
There are some seasonal adjustment problems with December employment because it's hard to get the Christmas season hiring right, and so this may not come out after you readjust in January. It may not be as bad as it looks, but at this point December looks like it's going to be another really dismal month.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, the chart on the top of page 6 is 2008, then, or not predicted for 2009. That's,
yes. It's the chart on the top of page 6, that not the dark bar but the middle bar in the – that's for October and September, the kind of middle shaded bar. That's where we thought the economy was until last Friday. The dark bar shows the size of the revisions to September and October. The difference between the middle shaded bar and the dark bar is the data revisions. And then you can see that the rest of that is the first estimate of November job loss. Okay. Okay, I have shown you a graph that shows, that compares how the recessions, the prior recessions look, only this was based on the November graph. And so if you look at the bottom of page 6, you can see that the 2001 recession, the 1990-91 recessions, 4 years after the start of the recession, we were at 108% of where we were prior to the, at the peak before the recession occurred. In the 1980-82 recession, we were about 5.75% above, and that in this recession, in the November forecast, we would be at a little bit less than 4%. The area that's shaded in, the difference between the area that's shaded in and the solid heavy line with the round circles in it, that kind of shows you the difference, how the economy differed between the 80-82 recession and this recession. Okay, on the top of the next page is the same graph with a revision for December. And so now you can see that this recession looks a little bit worse than the 1980-82 recession, that we end up even further below at the end of the 2011 fiscal year, and that the area is kind of what you're trying to assess in terms of the total impact is the net areas between the two, the solid line with the dot and the shaded area, and it looks to me now that the white area, that the area where we have the economy down below where it would have been on an index basis for 1980-82 is greater than the little bits that where it was below the current level. So it looks to me like we're seeing something, we're forecasting something that is on the order of and maybe a little bit worse than the recession in 1980-82. Now, that said, I mean, that's all the bad news in here. One of the things that we do is, of course, we do a forecast for Minnesota, not for the U.S. economy. And while we base our forecast for Minnesota on the U.S. economy, we don't necessarily say the U.S. economy goes down, we're going to go down more, anything like that. We exercise some independent judgment. And my staff and I talked about this a lot, and we were not particularly confident in particularly the wage growth numbers that were forecast for the U.S. economy by Global Insight. We have an independent measure of wage growth for Minnesota, and we have actually better information, more timely information through the withholding receipts that we have than they do. So if you look at the bottom of page 7, what you see is something that was in the forecast book, but it shows that in our forecast, we had only 0.2% growth in wages forecast for calendar year 2009, whereas Global Insight had 1.2%. What we've seen is that Global Insight has come toward us in there between November and December. We might reduce our forecast, but it wouldn't be to the same extent that Global Insight has reduced their forecast. And so while these national figures are disturbing, the loss in Minnesota income and the loss in Minnesota revenues is likely to be proportionally less than would be done if you were thinking about this purely from a national perspective. We did not have the same kind of, we had a little bit weaker, a little bit more job loss in Minnesota than Global Insight had. We had a little bit weaker personal income than Global Insight had, and we would not necessarily automatically be dropping if Global Insight drops wages by 1 percentage point. We wouldn't necessarily be dropping wages by 1 percentage point because we've already anticipated some of that decline in our forecast. At the Senate Tax Committee, I said that just on some back-of-the-envelope estimates that we thought would cost us somewhere between $30 and $70 million in the current biennium, adding to the deficit somewhere between $30 and $70 million. We've used up some more envelopes and looked at it, and we're still comfortable with that. We have not done an actual forecast or anything like that. This is just information for guidance there. I think there's probably good reason not to do another forecast at this point, simply because there's so much more information that has yet to come out in terms of Christmas sales, in terms of what happens to end-of-year bonuses and beginning of 2009 bonuses, in terms of estimated tax payments. And news could be better or news could be worse, but it won't be really until the 1st of February when we start on the February forecast that all of that news is in. But this is just the 20 to 7 or 30 to 70 range is just to give you some idea of the fact, you know, it's material, but it's not doubling the problem or anything like that.
Okay, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, if the Congress passes an economic stimulus package in January, would that be taken into account in the February forecast?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, as long as it was passed, well, if it wouldn't even have to be passed, if the outline of it was clear and there was agreement on what the stimulus package was, it would be included in the February forecast. And to the extent that it included direct payments to states and we knew the amount of the direct payment to states, that would be included as well. So an example, say that there's I want a number here that I can do real quickly in my head. There's $50 billion of block grant money to the states, and it's going to be allocated on the basis of personal income or population, and Minnesota's about 2%. So that $50 billion means that we would get about $1 billion, and if that was in law, we would be adding that to transfers into the state as direct revenues. So yes, it will be added in.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, would you also be taking into account any jobs program that the federal government might include in a stimulus package?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, again, if it were current law and if we're in, or if Global Insight had this in their forecast, we would be taking it into account.
So if somebody else counts it, then we would count it.
If it's in the, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, if it's in the national economic forecast, we would count it. If there is some way that we know that, and that there's going to be 2,000 jobs created, a CCC-type program or something like that in Minnesota that would create 2,000 jobs, we would adjust our employment estimates to that. If there's just kind of vague, ambiguous statements about some of this will go to the states or something like that, then we would do something thinking about kind of what our pro rata share would be, but would come out through the model probably, wouldn't be a special adjustment.
Okay. Any other questions? Dr. Stinson, thank you so much. And have a good holidays the best you can. And again, we appreciate your thoroughness and thoughtfulness. Okay, members, last thing on the agenda then is we're going to have Mr. Steve Hine from the Department of Employment and Economic Development talk to us about the job situation more specifically. Also, I'm going to have passed out, last meeting I passed out a first cut of budget, potential budget guidelines we could be using this year, and it's been reworked by numerous people. And it's still a draft, but hope people will look at it and give us some more feedback. So, well, why don't you pass them both out together, maybe? Mr. Hine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Chairman Pogemiller, for the opportunity. I was asked to come to speak on labor market conditions over the past year or two and what they might mean, what these labor market conditions may look like in light of the projections that Dr. Stinson has mentioned over the next year or two. A number of charts here that I'd like to go through. The first chart there on the bottom of page one shows the job decline of the 2001 recession, the subsequent two-year period during which we experienced essentially static employment levels, and then 2 years of job growth that was on a par with the national trend that's shown in the red line. In early 2006, however, Minnesota began to lag the nation in employment gains, and by the time the nation has now officially gone into recession as of December of last year, that decline that began within the state in early 2006 produced a gap that was equivalent to about 47,000 jobs. The gap, of course, has now narrowed, but only as the national rate of job loss has exceeded ours since the official start of the current recession. Since January, Minnesota's lost 18,300 jobs through October for a 0.7% rate of decline, while the nation has lost nearly 1.4 million. That's since January, not the over-the-year figures that Dr. Stinson mentioned, or 1% rate of decline since then. Now, adding November's large loss brings these national numbers to the 1.9 million that was mentioned and 1.4% decline. I should perhaps preface all of the comments that I make about the slides here with the comment that we will be releasing our November employment and unemployment figures for November this coming Thursday. So we're only getting a very early look at those numbers right now, but we will have a much better idea on Thursday regarding the state impact of that substantial decline in employment that we saw nationally. The next chart shows the rate of growth and decline here and nationally across the 11 major industry sectors between October of 07 and this past October. Of course, again, using November's national figures would make matters look worse from the national perspective, but I kept with October here just for the sake of an appropriate comparison to the state. One area that stands out is financial activities, where Minnesota has added 2,800 jobs, or 1.6% over
Mr.
the
Chair,
year.
Senator
Sinjo?
May I ask I'm trying to follow you on your charts. Which chart are you on right now?
I'm sorry, the one on the top of page 2.
Thank you.
Job growth by sector over the past year. Again, in financial activities, we've added 2,800 jobs, or 1.6%, while the nation has lost over 140,000. Overall, the state is outperforming the nation in 5 of the 11 sectors, but we're only growing in 3 of 11. In addition to financial activities, education and healthcare services and government have added jobs over the past year, while losses have been greatest in construction, manufacturing, and professional and business services. The following chart...
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines, I was looking at the chart you were just talking about and noticed the one line is natural resources, and Minnesota shows a growth there. And I'm curious what industries or what activities are included in that natural resources category.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson, the natural resources would include mining, and that's predominant in Minnesota. It would also include oil and gas exploration. It also includes things like sand pits and things like that. I want to clarify that in Minnesota we have seen a decline in that area over the past year, while nationally we've seen a dramatic increase of 9.5%.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines, I'm thinking about all the work that we have that goes on in like wildlife management areas and the restoration of prairie. Where that's employment, is that included in here?
Senator Frederickson, Mr. Chairman, that to the extent that is done in the private sector as opposed to the government sector, that would be included in this area. Although it is a relatively small sector, overall there's roughly 6,000 jobs in that sector. So going on to
Mr. Hines,
I'm sorry. Follow-up, I think that question maybe comes from LCCMR's discussion, but some of those projects are not government sector directly. I mean, they're under contract, you know, the private nonprofit and what have you. How do you calculate those? Or even the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure if you'd consider that government sector or not.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the employment at the university would be included in the state education component of the government sector. To the extent that there are businesses out there that would be classified as natural resource management, as opposed to being in the nonprofit service providing area, they would be included in the natural resource and mining sector.
And Mr. Chairman, perhaps Representative Carlson and I should make a little further comment. We've made our recommendations 2 days ago on our funding recommendations for the Environmental Trust Fund, and certainly our recommendations are zeroed in on natural resource and environment, but a close subset to that, we were looking at projects that would also might provide jobs for Minnesotans. So there'd be kind of a dual positive to them, the environment and natural resource side, but also we gave some emphasis to those projects that would provide employment for people. Senator Sinjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if you'd just comment on the education health services category along the lines that I'm believing that the education category is generally a lot of you know, public schools, universities, Minsku, and so on. It's a lot of colleges and publicly funded entities, whereas health service is probably more private sector, although certainly dependent on government aid. But if you were to break health service and education out, would one grow and one not grow, or would both grow about the same?
Senator Sinjum, Mr. Chair, good question. Actually, the state and local education components are part of government. So the public schools and the university and Minsku, those are part of government. What's within the educational component of the education and healthcare services, that's strictly the private educational entities, including primary and private colleges and universities. In terms of the breakout, healthcare has certainly been growing relatively rapidly over the past year. The healthcare component alone has grown by 7,800 jobs, or 2.1%, while the private educational services has decreased by nearly 700 jobs, or 1.2%. So that growth that is represented in this chart in education and health at this point in time is due to growth in the healthcare services component.
Okay. Is there a logic for combining these on this chart, or you just did it for space? Or
Good question. There's actually some discussion at the national level, and we are obligated to abide by national or federal government reporting standards, and they dictate to us what kinds of aggregations. But there is serious discussion about breaking those two up because of the incongruities in their employment patterns, as well as, you know, that they're not a good match. Yeah.
So the education health services is all private. The government includes public education.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
Senator Berglund, was it?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hine, this is from October of 07 to October of 08. So the recent round of layoffs by hospitals in Minnesota would not be showing in this graph.
Senator Berglund, that's correct.
It's pretty startling, too.
It's still a little early to tell whether they'll even show up in November's numbers, depending on the timing of those layoffs. The survey that underlies these asks for a count of employees that are on payrolls during the pay period that includes the 12th of the month. So to the extent that those layoffs have been announced, but people do not leave the payrolls until sometime later, those employment counts would only reflect that at the time of the departure from payroll.
So how much do you expect that would impact this area?
The recent announcements? Well, all I can say is that the numbers that were released would be anticipated to be reflected in the payroll counts. I will get to looking at the next year's employment changes, sector by sector.
Okay. Representative Simon?
Real quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that there's no Minnesota bar for service producing. Is that because it's at zero?
Exactly.
Good eye.
I had to double check that myself. Okay. Turning to the next slide, that tracks Minnesota's unemployment rate relative to the nation. I guess this will be at the bottom of page 2. Certainly another measure by which Minnesota has slipped relative to the nation is in this unemployment rate. After 30-plus years of an unemployment rate that averaged about 1.5 percentage points below the nation's, Minnesota's rate matched the U.S. rate in December 2006 for the first time and has averaged only 1/10 of a point lower than the national rate since then. The October rate of 6% here in Minnesota is higher than the peak rate of the previous two recessions and is now at a level last seen in early 1986 as we were coming out of that double-dip recession that Dr. Stinson mentioned. If common predictions of a national rate reaching near 9% come to pass and we continue to match the national rate, we will come close to reaching our previous all-time peak. That is dating back to 1976 when we started collecting data at the state level on unemployment. We will reach that all-time peak by early 2010. The next slide reflects the number of individuals that are unemployed that go into the determination of that unemployment rate. The number of people unemployed has also spiked recently, having risen by 50,000 between January and August of this year, and also approaching the all-time peak of 196,000 individuals that was reached in late 1982. Of course, this is a comparison to a much smaller labor force back then, but we're also well above the number of unemployed during the 2001 recession, when we were only slightly smaller economy-wise than we are now.
Mr. Hine, may I ask a question? When we're talking about unemployment, there was an article in the paper the other day, and I think they picked it up on public radio as well, that the effective rate was really more like 12.5% when you considered the number of employees that are working with reduced hours. And I think another category was people who had worked for various companies under contract and were not statistically counted in the unemployment figures. I'm not sure about that second point, but the reduced hours, I know, is generated as compared to the official rate of 6%+.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does produce six alternative measures of unemployment. The so-called official rate is denoted U3, but there are three measures that include broader measures of unemployed. To be officially unemployed, one needs to, of course, not have a job, but also be actively seeking work. These broader measures would include people that may have discontinued searching, actively seeking work.
The
discouraged worker effect is the common reference to that. But it would also include people that perhaps have transportation or childcare or other impediments to working, and so have discontinued work, although they would be interested in taking a job.
So, and this chart is showing us the.
This is only the official
rate, and the point I wanted to make is that many would argue that the effective rate is much higher.
That's right. Nationally, as the unemployment rate went to 6.7% officially, the broadest measure, which includes people working part-time that would prefer to work full-time, did reach that 12.5 that you mentioned.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. next slide, and I've lost track of what page we're on, but the one that's entitled Increase in Claims for Unemployment Benefits Reflects Layoffs.
Page three.
Obviously, the pace of layoffs has contributed to this falling employment and rising unemployment of late. This is a chart that reflects the surge in the number of new claims for unemployment benefits. Dr. Stinson mentioned yesterday's release of the new claims filed for unemployment benefits at the national level, having reached a 26-year high. As a sign that December is shaping up to be another weak month. So this is the state equivalent to that kind of measure. This chart illustrates the surge in the number of new claims for unemployment benefits, with the total number per month rising from 21,700 in May to 32,000 in November. That's nearly a 50% increase. Its November level also exceeds the number of people that were claiming benefits in October 2001 during the 9/11 aftermath. What we call SK claims, that's the data reflected by the red line there, those are claims that are filed by people that are not expecting to be called back to their previous job and so represent permanent layoffs rather than a total of permanent plus furloughed layoffs. Those permanent layoffs have also risen dramatically from just over 10,000 a year ago to 17,500 last month. That's a 70% increase in the monthly rate of permanent layoffs as measured by these particular claims.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines, could you tell us what the effect of this is going to be on our unemployment fund? When would employers be required to start increasing, or maybe they already are, their contributions to that unemployment fund? And will we be going into the red soon and borrowing from the feds?
We have done some analysis of that. I'm not prepared right now to indicate when we're going into the red, but there is the projection that the UI Trust Fund will go into the red at some point down the road, and I can't recall the magnitude nor timing of that.
I'm sure we'll hear that at another
I'm sure that if
probably Finance Committee
yes.
meeting.
You're saying the analysis has been done?
We do conduct an ongoing analysis of the UI Trust Fund condition, yes.
You would, I don't know if our staff has that yet, but if they don't, let's get it from Mr. Hine. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Turning to the next slide, the increase in number receiving and exhausting benefits, not only are the number of people that are filing initial claims increasing, but as a sign of the difficulty that these UI beneficiaries are having trouble finding reemployment are shown by the rising number of people that are continuing to receive benefits. That's the blue line, and that's up 51% over the year, as well as the number of people that are exhausting their eligible benefits before finding work, the red line, which is up 47% over the year. Again, those are per month seasonally adjusted levels. So nearly 70,000 people receiving benefits. As another measure of the difficulty that people are having finding jobs, the next chart shows a diminishment in the number of job vacancies. There are two different sources of information here: one for the nation and one for the state. The Bureau of Labor Statistics nationally conducts a monthly survey of openings, and that's reflected by the red line. We conduct a semi-annual, every 6 months, survey of job vacancies, and while we're just wrapping up the fourth quarter round, I can say that early indications are that we're going to see a fairly substantial further decrease in the number of job vacancies that we're estimating for the end of this year. This next chart, comparing 2008 recession to previous downturns, Dr. Stinson mentioned a few comparisons. This is perhaps a little confusing, but what I've done here is I've shown the relative employment level scaled to equal 100 at the official start of each of the last three recessions and the current recession, as well as the average over the 10 post-war recessions. And we can see that our rate of job loss, that's the heavy blue line, in the current recession, since the official start in December, actually hasn't been that great. All right? The rate of decline subsequent to the official start of the 10 post-war recessions was somewhat greater, and certainly the 2001 and 1982 recessions showed a more precipitous decline in employment than we have been seeing recently. Only the 1990-91 recession, which was very mild here in Minnesota, had a smaller rate of job decline during the months after the official start. However, on the other hand, the current conditions have been made worse by the slow rate of growth that we experienced going into the recession. In the 1 year before, you can see that with the exception of the 1982 experience, where that recession came on the heels of the 1980 recession, with the exception of that, we've had a much slower rate of job growth preceding this recession than we have in the past. In addition, current forecasts of continued job losses through 2009 would make the decline the longest on record. We've averaged 11 and a half months of recession in these 10 post-war recessions. And if we continue to lose jobs through 2009 and the official end of the recession is not declared before then, it would become the largest on record. That dashed line is very simply an extrapolation from current levels to the end of 2009, assuming the 50,000 job loss that Dr. Stinson has mentioned.
So zero is December last year?
That's right. It's December of 2007 for the current recession. It would be March of 2001 for the 2001 recession and so on.
But you've normalized it.
And I've normalized them all to equal 100 at that point in time.
But this zero is December 07. Okay.
Yeah.
I got it.
Right.
For the current, yes.
That's right. Exactly. Continuing to look at the consequences of that additional 50,000 jobs lost, if we continue to lose an additional 50,000 jobs over the past year, the next chart shows that we will have fallen below the employment peak reached in February 2001. Or in other words, this recession will have eliminated all the jobs gained during the recent six-year expansion. With the exception of that double-dip recession in the early 80s, when one recession followed another by only 1 year, this will be the first time that that has happened on record, that within Minnesota is going back to the through all post-war recessions. To get an idea as to where these jobs will be lost, if we look at the next slide, past and future annual job growth rates by sector, I incorporated the November forecast of a 50,000 job decline into our recent but now out-of-date short-term industry forecast. We have a practice of updating these short-term forecasts once every quarter, once every 3 months. We did so 2 months ago. Tom mentioned the difficulty in keeping up with conditions here when you're in the business of forecasting. So in order to quickly bring these up to date, I simply incorporated that 50,000 job loss into the relative rates of decline that we had predicted 2 months ago. Based on this, we can expect that all sectors, with the exception of the catch-all other services sector, will worsen compared to the job changes over the past year, and that all sectors except education and health again will lose jobs over the coming 12 months. Now, this chart is in percentage terms or rate of growth terms. The last chart shows where those job losses would occur in absolute terms. Shows the prediction that almost 9 of every 10 jobs over the next year that will be lost will be in construction, manufacturing, trade, and professional and business services. And it also shows, again, the one area of continued job growth, although that 0.7% rate of growth is far below the 4 to 5% rates of annual job growth that we have seen in that sector over the recent years. With that, I'll close and certainly entertain any additional questions.
A lot bigger than this.
You're sharing the burden of Dr. Stinson on the news front, huh?
Well, it's hard to avoid that doubled burden.
Appreciate Ms. Ryan's questions. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious with all of the publicity with the action of the Senate, U.S. Senate last night. We're all aware that there's the Ford plant here, but the suppliers, do you have any way of measuring what the impact might be with the auto industry if there were a bankruptcy and no stimulus package moving forward? I assume Minnesota has some suppliers. I would have difficulty identifying them beyond, like I mentioned, the Ford
Representative
plant.
Representative Carlson, the interdependence of suppliers and not only suppliers, but, you know, everybody else that receives receipt of expenditures by people that are deriving their income from the auto sector makes for a challenging exercise that we have not conducted. I did see a study done by the Economic Policy Institute, which I'd be happy to share with you. I believe the projected impact, if it was just one, I think it was General Motors, was 14,000 job loss, but it was somewhat greater if all three domestic auto producers went down. But I could certainly share that, and I wish I had it with me, but I'd rather
that
not.
Might be interesting with all the dynamics that are taking place currently. I think we're also, you know, generally aware of the retail part of it, and there's been articles about different dealerships and so on and the loss of dealerships. But my question was focusing more on the manufacturing part of it, and I have no idea what component that might be in our manufacturing in Minnesota, where we're feeding into the actual manufacturing of cars.
The size of the supplier, the manufacturing providers to auto industry, I would certainly be happy to try to come up with a number.
Yeah, it'd be kind of interesting to know what that impact might be as we move forward in the next few days.
Certainly this study
that may hit the
study
as early as the end of this month if something isn't done. But thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hine. If I could just ask, what's the normally it's H-I-N-E-S. Why is there it's H-I-N-E?
Just one of me.
But is there a reason?
There must be one way back, but okay. My family name I know goes back a long time since it was.
And which nationality is it?
British.
British. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just curious because normally it's with an S. I always thought it was an S till I just noticed today. Yours, I thought.
I'm very unique, I guess. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you very much, Ms. Ridley. And Dr. Stinson, thank you very much. Members, this will be the last fiscal policy meeting this year, I think. My expectation is that the speaker is probably going to use the committee some. She'll be the chair next year, and I hope she uses it. And appreciate your attendance, and don't forget.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
This may have been discussed at other times, but do you know where this came from?
Yes, it's a document in motion that I put out a draft last meeting.
Okay.
Asked people for input. It's been redrafted based on that input.
Okay.
And today I passed out, you might have been out of the room, and just said we're still looking for input from members, from the public. And my hope was that we could come up with a document like this that both houses were willing to work with. If not, my intent in the Senate is to come up with a document that we're going to work with.
Thank you.
Don't mean to force it on the House. I just, if it's something the House is interested in doing, I hope we could do that. But give us the Carlson. Give us that.
Oh, when you asked about the spelling, I discovered a few months ago that doing a little family research that Carlson, as you see spelled there, was actually back in Sweden, Karlsson. So those spellings do change over time.
This is your efficiency.
I was just going to mention that to you because of your question.
Your family efficiency. You've gotten rid of a letter and changed one. And
oh, it's all kinds of changes. Yes.
Americanized.
Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.
I was just because of you asking about this.
Members, don't forget.